Okay. VOA 1, the hits.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from Pete Musto and Anna Mateo. Later, Kelly Jean Kelly will present America's Presidents. But first, the World Health Organization, or WHO, warned on Monday that there might never be a silver bullet or an extraordinary solution like a perfect vaccine against COVID-19. WHO officials added that the road to normality would be long, and some countries would need to rethink how they deal with the health crisis. Johns Hopkins University estimates that by August 3rd, more than 18 million people around the world had been infected with the disease, and more than 690,000 had died. Also, some nations that thought they were over the worst of the crisis are experiencing a resurgence. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus urged nations to strongly enforce health measures. They include wearing face coverings, social distancing, hand washing, and testing. The message to people and governments is clear. Do it all, Tedros said from the United Nations Agency's headquarters in Geneva, Switzerland. He said face coverings should become a symbol of togetherness around the world. A number of vaccines are now in phase 3 trials, and we all hope to have a number of effective vaccines that can help prevent people from infection. However, there's no silver bullet at the moment, and there might never be, he noted. Tedros said, while the coronavirus is the biggest health emergency in almost 100 years, the international effort to find a vaccine is unlike anything seen before. The WHO chief also pointed to some concerns. We may not have a vaccine that may work, or its protection could be for just a few months, not more. Until we finish the trials, we will not know. Dr. Mike Ryan is the WHO's head of emergencies. He said countries with high transmission rates, including Brazil and India, needed to prepare for a big fight. The way out is long, he said, noting success will require ongoing efforts. Some countries are really going to have to take a step back now and really take a look at how they are addressing the pandemic within their national borders, he added. WHO officials also said an early investigation team had completed its China mission. The mission, demanded by the United States, was to search and identify the start of the virus. The U.S. is the WHO's top donor and plans to leave the body next year. The U.S. government accuses the WHO of being too easy on China.
CES, one of the world's biggest technology conferences, will be an online event this coming January due to the coronavirus health crisis. The decision marks a change for event organizers who said in May it would take place as a smaller in-person gathering in Las Vegas, Nevada. The decision also creates additional problems for Las Vegas. Like other popular vacation destinations in the United States, the city is suffering economically. More than 170,000 people attended the four-day show this past January, shortly before COVID-19 began to spread across the country. In Nevada, over the past 2 weeks, the average number of daily new coronavirus cases has increased 27%. The crisis has affected major technology events around the world. Web Summit, an event in Portugal that includes well-known heads of technology companies and famous people, will be online this time. Organizers aim to still hold a physical conference in Lisbon in December. But no final decision will be made until early October. Trade shows are a place where people meet members of the industry, try new devices, or make sales. The Events Industry Council reports that they represent $2.5 trillion in worldwide spending. Much of that is likely to be lost if events go online. The Consumer Technology Association organizes CES. It had said in May that it planned to hold some events in Las Vegas next year, but Gary Shapiro, the group's CEO, said the group's thinking changed as COVID-19 cases rose sharply around the world. That makes it impossible to hold an indoor event in January 2021. I'm Pete Musto.
From VOA Learning English, this is the Health and Lifestyle Report. The coronavirus pandemic has changed many things about everyday life. One big change is childcare, or the lack of it. As many childcare providers closed as part of public safety measures, so did schools, offices, and businesses. Social restrictions also tightened. This meant many older adults were unable to watch or care for their grandchildren. This left working parents with a sudden, unexpected problem. Working from home with children who also had schoolwork to do. Many parents struggled to meet work demands while watching over their child's online studies at the same time. Even companies, whose job it is to prepare for a pandemic, were caught off guard or unprepared. The British drug maker AstraZeneca spent years preparing for a health crisis. However, when it happened, the company was not prepared to help its employees work effectively at home with their children. The company asked its 8,300 employees about childcare and found that at least 1,100 needed help. Fiona Ciccone heads the company's human resources office. She noted that some employees said they were feeling worried about the work they had to do and about not getting it done. Several of those working parents are also responsible for trying to produce a vaccine for the disease COVID-19. So AstraZeneca did many things to help its employees by helping their children. The company found about 80 teachers and paid them to organize classes online. It developed a computer software program to make planning the lessons easy. And it also found tutors for children needing one-on-one instruction. Other businesses around the world did similar things to help their employees work through the coronavirus health crisis. German business software company SAP provided online lessons for children of its workers. Those classes taught performing magic, dancing, and learning to play a musical instrument. In Italy, tire maker Pirelli teamed up with RadioMama.it to provide online education and fun activities for children. Classes in English, creativity, and technology are among the most popular. However, not all parents have such support from their employer. Many are dealing with their own work, childcare, and online learning on their own. I spoke with one woman about her ways of dealing with the situation. Mary Shelley is a director of information technology at the University of Maryland, just outside Washington, D.C. She says when her son's learning went online, she needed strategies to manage her 13-year-old son's education. During the spring, Shelley says, it seemed easy to keep her son thinking about schoolwork. At that time, nearly all U.S. students were at home and taking classes online. But now, during the summer, her son is taking an online pre-algebra class. However, the methods she used during the regular school year are still helping her now. Shelley says the most important thing for her is this: wake up early and get herself organized first.
I try to get up early and get myself organized for the day and figure out what's critical to get done for myself and my own work.
Having a routine is important. A routine gives you set times for the things you need to do, such as waking, studying, taking breaks, eating, and exercising. When making that routine, involve your child. Ask for the child's help. Let them give input or ideas. This can help a child feel empowered. Shelley did this and says it gave her son ownership of the process. A child may be more willing to follow a routine if they helped to make it. Or, as our busy working mom says, craft it.
I've worked with him to try to craft a routine together and, to make sure that he's got input on that as well. And I think that's helped him to take ownership of his work and of his day.
After you set a routine, see how it works with your family and be ready to change things. Shelley describes her process as trial and error. She tried some things with her son to see what worked. At first, the rule was her son had to finish all his schoolwork before playing any video games. But she found that he works better if his work is broken up into two smaller learning periods, instead of one big, long one. The one consistent thing, she adds, all work is done by dinner.
The only thing that has been totally consistent is to have everything done before dinner. And so that leaves his evening free and leaves us free from hassling him in the evenings.
This helps Mary Shelley keep a balance between home life and work life. Experts say this balance is important as many of us continue to work from home. Experts also say that business leaders' positions toward working from home could help lead to higher productivity and loyalty. However, they also say that working from home also can present challenges. When work and home are living so close together, parents must set boundaries. They must know when to clock out and leave their work for the day. And that's the Health and Lifestyle Report. I'm Ana Mateo.
VOA Learning English presents America's Presidents. Today we are talking about Jimmy Carter. His given name was James, but he liked to be called Jimmy. Carter was elected president in 1976. Until he campaigned for the office, few Americans knew who he was. But Carter said his lack of experience with the federal government made him the best candidate. After witnessing years of problems in the White House, many voters appeared to agree with him. However, Carter's inexperience also became a problem. Some of the issues he faced were complex, and at times, they seemed overwhelming. After only one term, Carter failed to get reelected. But in time, his public image improved. His years after leaving the White House are generally considered more successful than his time in office. Jimmy Carter was born in the southern state of Georgia. He was the oldest of four children. His father was a businessman. His mother was a nurse. The family owned a store, as well as a peanut farm and warehouse. Although the businesses did well, Jimmy Carter grew up very modestly. His family's house did not have electricity or running water. But he was hardworking and wanted to be successful. As a boy, he saved enough money to buy four houses. He earned more money by renting them to other people. He also decided to attend college at the United States Naval Academy, and in time, he did so. Carter was an excellent student, and he became a fine naval officer. As a midshipman, Carter worked on one of the country's first nuclear submarines. He later taught nuclear engineering to other crew members. But Carter's promising career in the Navy ended after only 7 years. His father was dying, and the family farm was in trouble. Carter, his wife, Rosalyn, and their three sons decided to return to Georgia and try to save it. The first years back on the farm were difficult. But in time, the business became successful again. Carter began to turn his attention to other issues. He became involved in his church, local school, hospitals, and libraries. When he had a chance to compete for a position in the state senate, he took it. As a politician, Carter developed an image as an independent thinker who tried to save the government money. He also acted and spoke strongly against racial discrimination. In Georgia at the time, many voters did not agree with Carter's support of racial equality. In 1966, even his own Democratic Party did not choose him to be its candidate to represent Georgia in the U.S. Senate. So Carter began campaigning for the office of state governor instead. In 1970, he was elected. As Georgia's governor, Carter was known as a social and political reformer. However, historian Robert Strong notes that Carter did not always work well with others in his party. Strong teaches at Washington and Lee University in Lexington, Virginia. He writes that some Georgia lawmakers believed Carter was arrogant. He could appear to think he was morally right, and they were morally wrong. Carter's difficulty in getting along with other officials proved to be one of the problems he would later face. But in the presidential election of 1976, many Americans seemed to like this quality. The little-known governor from Georgia defeated the sitting president, Gerald Ford. Carter won, in part, by saying that he was different than other politicians. He was, he said, a Washington outsider. Then suddenly, Carter was the biggest insider of all, the American president. One of the things Carter wanted to do was change the image of the president. Earlier leaders, such as Richard Nixon and Lyndon Johnson, had increased the power of the presidency. Nixon had also been shown to be dishonest and resigned from office. Carter promised never to lie to the American people. And on the day of his swearing in as president, he purposefully tried to keep things simple. He walked to the White House from the U.S. Capitol building instead of riding in the back of an automobile. His wife wore clothes that she had worn in public before. The National First Ladies Library notes that her choice of clothing sent a message of an old American value of thrift or respecting money and not spending it needlessly. What she wore was meaningful because the country was going through difficult economic times. The Carters wanted to show that the new government would work to cut costs. They also wanted to show that they were there to help the American people, not enjoy the powers of the White House. But in the end, the Carter administration received poor ratings in surveys of public opinion. President Carter had trouble dealing with U.S. lawmakers, even when his party was in control of Congress. One result was that Carter could not advance many of his ideas for legislation. He appeared ineffective. Many historians point out that, in fact, Carter had a number of successes. He helped reduce the country's dependence on foreign oil. He took steps to make the federal government more efficient and to improve the environment. He appointed a number of women and racial minorities to top government jobs, an important move at a time when many were pressing for women's rights and civil rights. And in many cases, Carter supported human rights causes, both in the United States and around the world. But the public generally did not see Carter for his successes. Instead, many Americans blamed him for the country's economic problems. Some also disliked the way he spoke to them. In one speech, Carter blamed the country's troubles on what he called a crisis of confidence. Some listeners were offended. He also decided that the U.S. would not attend the 1980 Olympic Games in Moscow. The move was meant to punish the Soviet Union for its involvement in Afghanistan, but many Americans believed the move mostly hurt young American Olympians. The administration also faced other problems. The president was never accused of wrongdoing, but other high-level officials were. So was the president's brother, Billy. As a result, Jimmy Carter's public image for honesty suffered. Then came the Iran hostage crisis. The conflict between the United States and Iran had a long history. One part involved the Shah of Iran. The U.S. government had supported his rise to power, partly because American interests wanted to control Iran's oil. But the Shah severely abused his power. Many Iranians resisted. Some wanted a leader who would more closely obey Islamic teachings. In 1979, under pressure from those Iranians and others, the Shah fled the country. By now, he was suffering from cancer. So, as a humanitarian act, President Carter permitted the Shah to come to the United States for medical treatment. The move made Iranians angry. In protest, a group of students seized the U.S. Embassy in Tehran, the capital of Iran. They took 90 people, including 66 Americans, hostage. Carter worked hard to get the hostages released. He tried diplomatic negotiations and economic restrictions, but his efforts did not work. Finally, he tried a secret military operation. He sent 8 helicopters and a team of special forces to enter the embassy and rescue the hostages. But that operation failed too. The weather was bad. 3 of the helicopters crashed. 8 Americans were killed. And the public's approval of Jimmy Carter dropped even more. After 444 days, the remaining hostages were released. In exchange, the U.S. government agreed to end some of its economic sanctions against Iran and promised not to interfere in the country's affairs. None of the hostages had been seriously hurt. But the crisis was the final blow to Carter's presidency. A few months before they were released, his effort to seek re-election failed. As president, Carter did not meet the high expectations he had set for himself, and he faced some unusually difficult situations. His presidency also suffered from his problems communicating effectively with Congress, the media, and the American people. But his 4 years as president did leave several marks on the office. For one, he showed that the U.S. president could help other nations and sides resolve their disputes. Carter's best-known success as president was his help negotiating the Camp David Accords. The Accords were a peace agreement between Egypt and Israel. Carter led the talks at Camp David in Maryland. Carter's efforts to protect human rights overseas also influenced the foreign policy of later presidents. In time, his work as a defender of human rights has become his most important legacy. Several years after leaving the presidency, he founded the Carter Presidential Center at Emory University in Atlanta, Georgia. The center seeks to prevent and resolve conflicts, enhance freedom and democracy, and improve health. In addition to his work there, Carter has helped build houses for people who need them, written books, and negotiated with world leaders to take steps toward peace. In 2002, Carter received the Nobel Peace Prize for his efforts. I'm Kelly Jean Kelly.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.